on radio, streaming live on investtalk.com, and for our podcast subscribers. This is InvestTalk, above average investing for the average investor. InvestTalk is made possible by KPP Financial, a registered investment advisor firm serving clients throughout the United States. And now, KPP Financial Executive Vice President, Financial Advisor Justin Klein.
Good afternoon, everybody, and welcome to InvestTalk. This is our Monday, August 10th, 2015 edition of InvestTalk. And I can't believe summer is over, halfway over. It's been an interesting summer, and today was really no exception. So we welcome you to InvestTalk. We're reaching out to all types of investors via radio, streaming live on investtalk.com, and also to our many hundreds of thousands of podcast subscribers all over the world through iTunes, TuneIn Radio, and all the other podcast outlets that are available in today's technologically advanced world. So I said we're reaching out to investors, right? Investors. And there's a lot of times people confuse that between investors and speculators. They think that a speculator is an investor, and maybe vice versa. Our goal is for everybody to become better investors, not speculators. Paying attention to the news, a lot of times that's about speculation, but being an investor is a whole nother endeavor that really takes a lot of time, effort, knowledge, and discipline. And you may think of yourself as an investor, but of course, if you have money in a 401k or an IRA that you set up at a bank or any other number of ordinary investment vehicles, that makes you an investor. At least you should want to be an investor. You're putting money at risk, and you need to have some knowledge behind the risks that you are taking to potentially get the gains that you are seeking. Now, of course, you can choose to be involved at any level. Some folks contribute regularly to their investment programs, but pay very little attention to it otherwise. You know, they let their advisor manage it. That's what most of our clients do, although, you know, many of them keep a strong eye on it as well. And some folks, you know, they really are involved. Some people really want to know what their money is put in. They manage themselves, etc. So it's a wide range of investors out there, but no matter what, you need to have some knowledge, some basic knowledge. Even if you're fairly hands-off, you need to be cognizant of the risks that are being taken on your behalf. Now, if you're listening to this program, the odds are you're probably more involved than the average. And Steve and I try to pass along information that will help you make better decisions and feel more confident about the decisions you're making. Now, even though investing is a numbers kind of endeavor, you really can't just play it strictly by the numbers. There's interpretations, adjustments. And as Steve has said, it's as much an art as it is a science. Now, of course, your personal situation is going to be a little different than your neighbors or your family members or your friends. So you need, or someone needs to help you. And it could be somebody at work, maybe an advisor for your 401k plan. Hopefully there's someone there to help you. And we try to help in that process as well in this program. So let's get to work right now answering your questions. And you can get through to me during this hour. 888-99-CHART is our number, 888-992-4278. And you'd like to get a question between times, you can always call that exact same number 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And leave your message, leave your question, and we will answer it on the next show. So let's take this question that came in before today's program.
Hey guys, this is Corey from Mesa. I had a question about target prices. If a stock is 80, and the analyst says, oh, we have a target price of 105. When is that target price? Is it a year from now? Is it 6 months from now? Is it 3 months from now? Thanks for the help.
Usually they're talking about a year from now. That's fairly standard. Maybe other analysts might be looking at it differently, but it's usually a year from now. Now, one thing everybody has to understand about analyst target prices, this is an educated guess. It's really what it is. It's an educated guess. Now, what type of education are behind these educated guesses? Well, first off, it's usually some sort of projections about earnings. And this is by talking to the company, the CFO, people within the industry, understanding the industry, etc. Okay. So, and then they give a price projection for earnings going out over usually 12 months, maybe 18 months, right? Typically, the farther out the projection is, the more bullish that earnings projection is going to be. That's typically, especially in this latest bull market cycle, analysts are projecting big growth down the line, and as we get closer and closer, it's been downgraded and it's been more modest in earnings growth. And that's just the typical of this cycle and typical of other cycles as well. So that's where they start. And then they usually just base it off the multiples, average multiples within that industry. So if the industry as a whole is trading at 15 times earnings on average, well, a lot of times they'll just take whatever they think earnings are going to be for the next fiscal year and multiply that by the multiple. And that's fairly standard. Not every analyst is like that, but that's kind of the basis that they go, and they may make adjustments here or there based on if their upside projections to the earnings could be reached, if they think the multiple expansion within the industry are going to be higher, etc. So remember, this is just educated guesses based on multiples and projections. And the projections could be wrong. The multiples for the industry could shrink. You know, the commodity space is a good example. You know, the commodity has been falling. And a year ago, nobody really knew that oil prices would be this low. And so projections for earnings and multiples for the industry were much, much higher. And now they have to adjust. So understand that analysts are usually, in Steve's book, he always says analysts are wrong. A lot of times they're wrong a little, and many times they're wrong a lot. So you kind of take analyst projections on the price a year from now with a pretty big grain of salt. Now, everyday investors can have access to investments that were only available to the wealthy. Now, are you ready for the new higher risk ETFs that are out there? It could be big risk, but big reward as well. And we're going to talk about that on the show today. So I want to get to that. I also want to talk about emerging markets. Emerging markets have really been beat up. They've had a tough time, but they had a good day today. And the big question is, when the Fed raises interest rates, is that going to cause problems in the emerging market space? And what countries are best positioned to handle potential volatility in the emerging market arena? And this could be very, very important. So I want to touch on that. I also want to talk about America's most overvalued and undervalued housing markets. Where are houses cheap and where are they expensive? Remember, real estate is a pretty localized game. Now, generally, when you have a housing bust, higher priced areas go down more, and they usually go up during a good time for housing. But and that's kind of reflected in these numbers, but I want to touch on that because I think a lot of people will be interested in it and give you a good sense of where our housing market is as a nation. And then third, I want to talk about how to play catch-up with your retirement savings. A lot of people haven't saved enough money. A lot of people aren't where they need to be with their savings. They need to save more. And the big question is, what are some good ways to play catch up where people are in their 40s, 50s, and a lot of times they wake up and they realize they only have a small savings. They don't have a lot in the way of actual actual money put away for retirement. And a lot of times they try to catch up, and they either do it the wrong way or maybe they don't realize some ways to catch up. So we're going to talk about that as well. So those are my main talking points, but I also want to hear what is on your mind. What are you thinking about? Okay, let's hear what is eating at you when it comes to your money, whether it's an individual stock that you own or maybe you want to purchase. Maybe it's about interest rates, real estate, insurance, taxes, health insurance, trust. There's so many avenues we can go down on today's show. So whatever questions you have, give us a call. Let's take a quick look at the market today. The Dow was up 242 points. Very good day for the Dow. The NASDAQ up 58 points, not quite as good. Dow was up 1.4%. NASDAQ was up 1.16%. The S&P was up about 26 points, 1.25%. Small caps kind of lagged today. They were up, let's see, they were up 1.1%. So NASDAQ and the Russell were not up as much as the Dow or the S&P. And I say this a lot, but it's important when you're looking at the moves in the market for the day to give it a is it as better than it looks or is it worse than it looks? And you hear a Dow up 242 and you say, well, that's a very good day. But you always want to look at the NASDAQ and small cap stocks because that's where risk is really taken. And you want those to be doing better than the Dow on up days and obviously better than the Dow on Dow days as well. And today you had the NASDAQ and the small caps lagging the overall bigger indexes. So it was a nice up day on rally in China. You had Warren Buffett taking over Precision Castparts, making a very large acquisition for Berkshire Hathaway. And that was really what sparked the industrial space. So there were some good things going on in the markets today, but it's still, I think, an oversold bounce, and the markets are in a relatively weak position. Now, InvestTalk is made possible by KPP Financial. One of our most popular investment programs is our Balanced Income Program. This investment approach primarily focuses on attaining an income stream through stable dividend-paying companies and quality corporate bonds. And you can find out more about it on InvestTalk.com or give us a call at 888-99-CHART.
Did you get your dose of Steve today? Steve Peasley's market commentary can't always put things right in the market, but it can put things into perspective. There for you every morning on InvestTalk.com.
Let's talk about these newfangled ETFs. There's some pretty interesting ones that are coming out today. You know, the ETF industry is growing rapidly. We're now over $2 trillion in assets globally in these ETFs. And there's some new ETFs out there that you can't really get in mutual fund form. You know, mutual funds kind of the old world. There's still, I think, $18 trillion in mutual funds. There's way more money in mutual funds than there is in ETFs. But the growth is really in the ETF space. And the ETFs can get a little bit more creative with the structure that they employ and the strategies that they employ. And a lot of times, and now you can get access to strategies that only were able to be employed with hedge funds. And wealthy individuals and sophisticated institutional investors could only invest in. And one example of this is a very pretty interesting one. It's not heavily traded, so the volatility, or at least the liquidity, is not as big as I would like, but it's a very interesting concept. It's by Reality Shares. They're based out of San Diego, and I'm not pushing them or anything, but it's just a good example of this. Is what they do is they invest in the dividends of businesses, right? Because a lot of people are after the dividends. They're after dividends of stocks, right? Well, if the business of those particular companies you own goes south, the stock will go south as well, and you lose principal. Or maybe just the market as a whole goes south. And it goes south. It may even not go down as much as the market. but you're still losing money because you're in a bear market. Well, this uses derivatives, and it basically pulls out all the dividends out of a company. So you get exposure to the dividends and the dividend growth. If they raise their dividend, you get more dividends. You know, the companies that they're basically investing in. So it's a pretty interesting concept. So if the stock market go down, you're not subject to that capital depreciation, but you still get those dividends coming as long as they don't cut their dividend. So it's pretty interesting what you have available out there in today's market. Now, a large number of Americans have missed the six-year bull market, and a recent survey shows that more than half Americans are currently not investing in the stock market. So give us a call. How do you get back in? 888-99-CHART.
Thanks again for subscribing to our podcast, Fact Checking 5 Wrong Ideas About Investing. That's our talking point for Monday's podcast. We hope you'll join us then.
Now let's get back to work answering your questions today. Get your question to us anytime. You can call our 24-hour listener line, 888-99-CHART, and we will answer your question on the next program.
Yeah, hi, Steve and Justin. My name's David from Portland, Oregon. I'm a podcast listener. I'm in the Warren Buffett camp of buying blue chip dividend stocks when nobody wants them. And two stocks that are on my radar right now are ExxonMobil and Verizon Wireless. I would like your take on those two. If you could give me a good entry point, is now a good time to buy Verizon and ExxonMobil? And if you had to choose one or the other, which one would you think is a better buy right now? I'd love to hear your thoughts. Thank you very much.
I was looking at Verizon and ExxonMobil, looking for those dividend payers. Verizon yields about 4.75%. ExxonMobil yields about 3.6%. So Verizon a little bit better. Both I like. We actually own these in our dynamic growth program. We're being a little more conservative in that program right now. But we do both. We recently bought Exxon. We've owned Verizon for a while now. Exxon is a great. I think commodities have bottomed. I think today was a breakout for the commodities space. And I think the dollar's about to go down. And I think Exxon is a screaming buy at these levels. And that's why we picked it up. So I would lean towards Exxon as my over Verizon. I like Verizon. We still hold Verizon. We are keeping an eye on Verizon, though, because of the issues in the wireless space. And T-Mobile is doing pretty well. They're coming out with some innovative plans and getting people off of these locked-in contracts, and they're really putting pressure downward on the cost of wireless plans. And while Verizon is certainly the best, they have the best network. They do very well, and their business is still very strong. I do worry longer term whether the problems of T-Mobile, the competitor that T-Mobile is, if they will steal the Verizon's business, or a lot of Verizon. And so far, we haven't seen that. But I could see that happening in the future. So we're keeping an eye on it. Verizon still has a great business, strong cash flows, still doing very well, but I would be, I wouldn't say worried about Verizon. We are keeping an eye on Verizon. So longer term, I think Exxon is definitely cheaper now on a relative basis, even though the dividend is not as high, but this is a great time to be getting into oil plays, I think, for the long term. So I would pick Exxon over Verizon, but I like them both. Now let's talk a little bit about emerging markets. And emerging markets have done very well over the long recent past. I would say ever since 2000 and really, 2000 or so. You saw emerging market stocks do great. They had a big crash with the 08 bubble and everything. That's understandable. But since January 2005, the MSCI Emerging Market Index has gained roughly 150%, which is much better than the S&P 500. That's through July 27th of this year. And now the big issue is, if the Fed raises rates, are emerging market stocks going to get hit? And everyone should kind of understand why that might happen. And it's really what is called the carry trade. And the carry trade simply is you borrow where rates are low and you invest where rates are high. And guess where rates are low? In the U.S., because the Fed funds rate is near zero. We've been stuck on zero interest rate policy for now 6 years, a long, long time. And the big question is, will that trade reverse? You have rates go up here in the U.S., and now the spread, right, you're paying very little in interest to borrow here, and you're investing at high interest somewhere else. Now that spread starts to shrink. And now that risk versus reward is not as good. And so what happens is investors start to sell their emerging market assets, their foreign assets that are yielding higher, and they start to pay back the loans that they're paying, the lower interest rate that's now going up, right? So that's what that's the worry, is that there will be a reversal in the carry trade. And that happened in the taper tantrum in 2013 when Ben Bernanke came out and said we're going to taper QE and get off of the QE medicine. And they did that, and emerging markets sank in mid-2013, and then they rebounded until middle of last year, and they sank again. And I mean, it's been going really back and forth ever since then. And so the big question is, what countries are going to be affected the most? And you've kind of already seen that. But also, what countries are best situated to handle this potential volatility? So after the break, I'm going to talk a little bit about that. Also, coming up on InvestTalk Personal, when can I stop paying mortgage insurance? That's in the next half hour right here on InvestTalk, where you can turn for straight talk about your money, and we're always open to your questions. 888-99-CHART. So before the break, I was talking about emerging markets and the carry trade, about how when rates rise, you're going to have investors selling their assets in emerging markets because they're high yielding, and paying back loans on the debt that they have accumulated here in America or in other low interest rate countries. And that is what the carry trade is. And one of the reasons why the dollar strengthened is the Fed's no longer doing QE. That tightens monetary policy. They sell the foreign assets, right? Sell those foreign assets, and they need to convert those into dollars to pay back their loans. You see how that works and why the dollar is strengthened, why emerging market economies have weakened. And the big question is, what emerging market areas are best able to handle these problems? And there's really three main characteristics of countries that are best positioned to withstand the capital withdrawal from these financial investments. And first is current account surplus, meaning economies that trade or they export more than they import. That's a current account surplus. We have a current account deficit. We import more than we export. Okay? And why is that? Well, if you import more than you export more than you import, A, you gain foreign currency reserves. That's what China has. Meaning if they have problems in their economy, they can use those foreign currency reserves to shore up their economy. They can spend those on stimulus measures. They can spend it on to back banks, etc. They can use those in times of crisis to support their economy. Okay, and then if their exports are higher than their imports, and their currency goes down, all of a sudden their exports become even more competitive in the global marketplace, so they'll be doing better. But if they're net importers like we are here in the US and their currency goes down, well, the imports become more too expensive. The exports get a boost, but your imports suddenly become even more expensive because your currency is worth less. See what I'm saying? And then the big question is, how is their economy situated? Are they commodity importers or are they commodity exporters? Russia and Brazil are having problems right now because they're commodity exporters. I mean, they're reliant on those exports of commodities. It's best to have exports of things, goods, services, right? Because you're not at the whims of the commodity markets. So what countries are these? Well, Malaysia is probably number one. They've amassed a massive current account surplus and a significant foreign exchange reserve. And that's all because they have an export-driven economy. The World Bank data since 2005 shows that Malaysia's current account GDP and foreign exchange to GDP measures have constantly beaten an average of 21 large emerging market economies on a quarterly basis. So they are very, very strong. What other countries? Korea and Taiwan. Both of them have significant foreign currency reserves. And this just goes to show that not all emerging markets are the same. Russia and Brazil are very different than Korea and Malaysia and Taiwan. But all are considered emerging markets. That's why I think emerging market Asia, if you're going to get exposure to emerging markets, but I think now is a great time to do it, that is where you want to be. Now, what are the countries that aren't particularly ready for the Fed to raise rates? Well, Poland and Turkey are two. And the reason is because they consistently have run a current account deficit since 2005. And their foreign exchange reserves are depleted. They don't have enough money to really support their economy if they get into dire straits. So I like this topic because a lot of people don't understand, A, the carry trade, and they don't understand the difference between various emerging markets. They're very different economies based on very different factors. And based on the market that we're in, if you're going to put money to work, you want to be putting your money to work in the right areas, not just in a broad emerging market basket, right? You want to target the attractive areas in the market, not just a general asset class. All right, let's go to Davinver in San Jose. Did I say it right? Davinver?
Yes.
There we go.
Yeah.
What can I do for
you? Can you tell me the Caterpillar or the PG, the stock is, which stock is better to buy?
Caterpillar or Procter & Gamble? Is that what you're looking at?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. Well, I can listen to radio.
Okay, sounds good. Well, Caterpillar is certainly having some issues, a lot of issues, because of the problems in the mining space, the problems in the oil patch, etc. And their revenues are now falling, and they have been falling really since 2012. So Caterpillar is not doing so hot. But Procter & Gamble, they are also having their issues, a lot to do with foreign currency reserves. I'm stuck on the foreign currency reserves. A lot because of the strength in the dollar. They're a multinational company. They have business all over the world, and the strong dollar is a headwind to their business. Now, I think the big question you have to ask yourself is, what type of risk do you want to take? Caterpillar is higher risk, higher reward. It's down in the doldrums. Long term, it's still a great company. They're not going away. The big question is, what has a better long-term return on capital for me? What is a better long-term return on capital? And I would say that's probably Procter & Gamble. And Procter & Gamble is probably lower risk as well. So if I'm going to pick one of the two, I'm going with Procter & Gamble. They're both good. I think they both have – they're both relatively cheap. They've come down a lot because of the strong dollar. But Caterpillar is higher risk, and you know it's subject to the mining industry, oil industry, the building industry, business really all around the world when it comes to moving things, whether and you have to move things to build things, to mine things. It takes a big machinery. So I think Procter & Gamble is cheaper. I believe, a higher dividend. Look. But it's to me, it'd be more attractive, but I like both. Let's go to James in New York. How are you doing, James?
I'm good, Justin. How are you tonight?
Great. What can you do for you?
Yeah, I wanted to ask about RIG, Transocean, RIG.
Mm-hmm.
I bought the stock a while back at about $20 a share when it dropped, probably about a year ago.
Yep.
It was paying a very, very nice dividend around that time. And it's pretty much just been dropping since then gradually, and the dividend has kind of adjusted accordingly. So it's no longer any prospect that I thought maybe it could have been or would have been, but I don't know if this is a point for me to cut my losses and maybe dump RIG, or if I should maybe hang on to it in hopes that it might bounce back or, you know, profit somewhere down the road.
Yeah.
I'm just having some thoughts.
Yeah, well, this is Transocean. RIG is a symbol, and they're an offshore contract driller. And with oil prices so low, it makes their business very difficult, and that's why they've cut their dividend, and they're on hard times. Now, I think oil prices have and commodity prices have bottomed for the next year, 2 years or so. So I think you're going to be okay for the next couple years. However, my issue is with oil prices longer term. I don't think we're going to see oil sustainably above $100 a barrel long term. I think you'll have a rally in oil probably into the high 70s, $80 range, somewhere in there. And at those levels, RIG suddenly becomes profitable again, and it suddenly starts to look to be in a pretty good situation. And I strongly believe that will happen. And I think you will be making money on RIG a year from now. I think it will be above $20 a share. Okay. But you need to be, this isn't, I think, a name you want to hold long, long term. I think this is a year, 2 year play. I think the dollar is going to get weaker. I think commodity prices are going to go up and RIG's going to do well because of it. But I don't like that they're in the deep water segment, meaning they now have high costs, higher costs than average, and now they're competing with fracking. And fracking has become pretty pretty cheap, a lot cheaper than it used to be. And, you know, deep water used to be the marginal supply of oil, right? When the traditional wells were not enough to supply the world with enough oil, it was the deep water rigs. Well, I think now, at least for the next 10 or 15 years, fracking is going to be the marginal supply. And that's why I'm not a big fan of RIG long, long term. I think they'll be fine the next 5 years or so, but it's not something I would hold for an extended period. That makes sense, Jim?
Okay, so maybe just hold on to it for another year, year and a half or so, see where it comes from there, and then I'm not in position to get hurt by holding it at this point.
Yeah, I think you bought it, not at the exact bottom, but I think you bought it pretty cheap, and I think it will rally from here, but you know, I don't think it's going to get back to the heyday where it was trading at $150 a share or anything like that. Or even if I don't even think it's going to get back to $100 a share. I think if it gets back to 70, I think you count your lucky stars and you sell it. Even 50 is going to be big, big resistance. So I think it certainly could rally to those levels over the next year or so. But I wouldn't count on it much beyond that.
Okay, very good.
Thanks, James.
Thanks a lot.
Let's go to Chris in Kentucky. How you doing, Chris?
Pretty good, Jeff. How you doing, man?
Doing great.
I had a quick question on Ambarella, mm-hmm. AMBA,
yep.
And want to get your take and opinion on the company and a good entry point.
Well, Ambarella, this is a company that makes chips for GoPro, correct?
Yes.
Okay. I've looked at this name, and it's pretty expensive. It's growing dramatically, but it scares the living daylights out of me. And why is that? It's because all their business comes from GoPro, basically. The vast majority of their business comes from GoPro. And GoPro could either fall on hard times itself, or it could just switch its supplier of chips. I mean, there's all types of companies that make the types of chips that Ambarella makes. They develop semiconductors for processing solutions for video that enable HD video capture, sharing, and display. There's a lot of companies that do that. So certainly in the near term, it can keep going. But if one day GoPro says we're no longer using Ambarella or using some other chip company's chips, this will fall over 50% overnight. Could you handle that?
I could.
You could?
Yes.
Okay. Well, then, you know, it's not bad. You know, then if you can handle that volatility, then, you know, the net income is growing dramatically. To me, I would just buy GoPro.
Okay.
I mean, that's a better risk reward for me, because then you don't have the GoPro can go and buy chips from whoever, and you're going to be tied to the success of GoPro. Where Ambarella, you're not only tied to the success of GoPro, but you're also tied to the decision by GoPro to continue to use Ambarella chips. So why not just tie yourself to one of those factors instead of creating the risk for both of those factors? So, you know, technically it's strong and it could keep going, extremely high risk. At a scale of 1 to 10, it's a 15. I mean, it's not something I would ever touch, because I've seen these things happen where all of a sudden they lose a contract and boom, the stock gets crushed. And not something I would be... Go for it.
Yeah, I feel like I missed a party on it, honestly, because it went up 300% in about 12 months.
So yeah, you're the upside. Yeah, sure, it could go to 150, maybe 200, but you're not going to go up 300% again in the next 12 months. I highly doubt that's going to happen.
Sure, sure.
So you know, it's if you want to take that risk, sure, you could go for another 20, 30, 40% on it. Certainly could do that, but this is very, very volatile, and it's too hot for my blood.
Could you talk about GoPro for a second?
I like GoPro. It's still a little expensive for my taste, but and I hear some issues. I hear some rumblings about a lot of competitors coming out of China that are very similar and a lot cheaper. You can get ones for $75-$100. So longer term, I worry a little bit about GoPro, but near term, I like it. So I would go with GoPro. Now we've got time for your questions before this hour is up. We have about 8 more minutes left in the show. Give us a call, 888-99-CHART.
Our podcast distribution is made possible each day by KPP Financial, Steve Peasley, President. And each month, Steve sets aside at least one day to visit with individual listeners to review their retirement portfolios. If you don't live within range of our California offices, you can still take advantage of this free service using Skype or telephone. To set a time, just go to investtalk.com and click on Schedule a Meeting or call 888-99-CHART and follow the prompts.
Now it's time for Invest Talk Personal, the everyday decisions we make that can have a lasting impact on our finances. When can I stop paying for mortgage insurance? Now, private mortgage insurance is insurance your mortgage lender takes out to protect against the risk of the buyer defaulting on payments. In other words, if your house goes into foreclosure and is sold for less than the mortgage amount, the PMI reimburses the loss suffered by the lender, and it usually is required that the buyer pay for this insurance if they put less than 20% down. And this policy is unlike any other in that you can't really go shopping for the best rate. The cost to you varies depending on your credit score and your down payment. So when can you stop paying? Well, now the law requires lenders to cancel PMI when your loan to value reaches 78% of the original value of your loan. Cancellation is automatic as long as you pay down your mortgage enough to achieve 78% loan to value balance. Your lender must cancel PMI regardless of your home's current market value. Now, if you think your home is appreciated enough to give you an 80% LTV, you can start the process of terminating the PMI. And to terminate the PMI yourself, however, you'll have to prove you've got the necessary equity with an appraisal. You've got to pay for an appraisal. And if you'd like to know more, there's a link to this Money Talks article right there on investtalk.com. Just look for the link to Invest Talk Personal article under the Talking Point link. Now, that's Invest Talk Personal for today. And if you have a question about real estate or any money matters, we're right here for you now at 888-99-CHART. Or write me a note. Click on the Contact Justin button or Steve on investtalk.com.
There's a link to today's Talking Point. Just look for the Monday, August 10th heading on investtalk.com. And if you have a question about any money matter, there's no reason to save it. Now's the time to call 888-99-CHART.
What are America's most overvalued and undervalued housing markets? Fitch came out with a report recently compiled by Forbes. They helped compile a list by Forbes of the five most overvalued and undervalued housing markets. And I think it was very interesting because there's two ways housing markets can become overvalued or undervalued. And Texas, if some people would say, well, Texas is super cheap and it's a good place to be. But in reality, it's actually overvalued. And why is that? Well, since 2011, housing prices have gone up 34%, but, and this is in Austin, sorry, Austin, Texas, housing prices have gone up 34%, but the metro economy, the gross metro product for Austin, grew at only 24% during that time span. And Houston is in the same situation, but even worse, 23% gross metro product from February 2011 to the end of last year, but housing prices grew 43%. And this is why, I think this is a good example of why housing prices appreciation there will probably slow. It's probably not going to crash, but it'll probably slow because that's really not the biggest problem. It just shows that prices have gotten out of whack recently with their economic fundamentals when it comes to incomes and economic activity. So that's one way that housing prices become overvalued. Another way is that investors came in or the inventory is very low. And one of those is Riverside, California, down here in Southern California, inland part of LA, Orange County. And it ranks as the fourth most overvalued market in the country. And they say it's about 17% overvalued. And they've experienced a 45% run-up in prices from November 2011 to the end of last year. But the economy only grew 10%. And most homeowners are still underwater. 39% of homeowners were underwater in 2012, and now it's still 14%, even after the price appreciation. So there's still a lot of homeowners that are underwater. Miami also overvalued for similar reasons as Riverside. undervalued city, or sorry, another overvalued, Phoenix, Las Vegas, also overvalued, undervalued, Detroit, Cleveland, and Providence, Rhode Island. I think that was pretty interesting. Now we're out of time for today. I'm financial advisor Justin Klein, and for Steve Peasley and everyone at KFP Financial, thank you for listening, and I hope you have a good evening. Let's meet here again tomorrow.
Because of the nature of the interactive dialogue inherent in the format of this program, it's important for listeners to understand that not all comments made will apply to them specifically. Nothing said shall be taken to be investment advice, or shall statements on this program be considered an offer to buy or sell securities. Such advice is rendered solely on an individual basis, and at times will require that the investor review a prospectus before investing. Steve Peasley and Justin Klein are principals of Klein, Pavlis, and Peasley Financial, a registered investment advisor. For more information regarding KPP's investment advisors, call 1-800-557-5461. InvestTalk is a copyrighted program of Klein, Pavlis, and Peasley Financial, which retains all rights.